I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Ethan Brown, founder of Beyond Meat, a company that makes meat using plant protein instead of animal-based protein. The goal is to make a healthier product that looks and tastes and smells like chicken or beef, using fewer natural resources and reducing the amount of pollutants. The single largest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions is livestock. Roughly 1,800 gallons of water is used to make 1 pound of steak. Ethan launched Beyond Meat in 2009, and the company's products are found in stores across the United States, including Whole Foods and Walmart. Ethan is originally from Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
I want to start by talking about meat's issues. Can you give me some more detail around that?
If you look at human health and you look at, you know, heart disease, diabetes, and cancer, you know, there's a growing recognition that there's a link between meat consumption and those health epidemics. And you know, the World Health Organization probably did the most definitive work most recently, where they put meat in a category, processed meat in a category that was the same as cigarettes. But then you go to climate. When animals are breathing, they're emitting carbon. And so it seems like a minor issue, but if you think about the number of animals we have on the Earth's surface and the fact they're all breathing, and you add that up, you actually come up with about 14% of greenhouse gas emissions being attributed to actually just the fact that animals are on the Earth's surface in such numbers and are breathing. And you look at natural resources. All across the country, we're having, you know, resource issues of one kind or another, depending on where you live. And then last, you look at animal welfare. Now, people on a handheld can see how their food's being made. And I think more and more people are saying, you know, I'm not in agreement with that particular system.
You said just the fact that the animals breathe yields a certain amount of carbon. Well, what about human beings? I mean, yeah, we breathe carbon dioxide, and of course that yields, that helps with photosynthesis. Yeah. But is there an amount of carbon even beyond that that yeah, also leads to, well, so, has so, a deleterious effect?
To put it in context, you know, we raise and we slaughter about 66 billion animals a year, right? So think of, you know, the human population is big, but it's a tenth of that, right? You know, so that's the issue.
So why isn't there more regulation? We think of the auto industry, for example, highly regulated to decrease the amount of pollution that it yields. Why has not the same amount of regulation existed in agribusiness? Is it just because of the strong lobbyists?
You know, it's a really interesting question, and I think it goes deeper than that. Certainly that is a factor. It's one thing to, you know, put a new app out or you know, I always talk about the landline versus a cell phone and that quick transition we had. It's another thing to change how we eat protein, right? I mean, it is, protein was such an important part of how we evolved. Prior to even when we were, you know, Homo sapiens, meat played an enormously important role in our development. You know, if you think about the human brain when we started to consume meat, it was about 600 cubic centimeters. You know, over the course of evolution, and I think largely due to nutrient-dense food that meat is, it grew to about 1,300 cubic centimeters, right? And what was happening was not only were we getting this really good nutrition, right, but it was reducing the workload on our stomachs. So all that excess energy could go to our brains. It would be unwise for me to say that people shouldn't eat meat. I think that's a mistake, right? Because I believe that meat is central to who we are. What I do think is possible and really exciting is that you can get away from the idea that meat has to come from an animal. And with the science we have and the understanding we have today of what meat is, you can build a piece of meat directly from plants.
So if we ask, you know, anybody, well, what is meat? They'd say, oh, it's the tissue that comes from an animal.
Yes.
So how would you define meat?
You know, the historical understanding, right, is, you know, and more recently is, you know, chicken has to come from a meat has to come from a chicken, cow, or pig. The composition of meat is something different, right? The composition of meat is basically amino acids, it's lipids, it's very small amount of carbohydrates, it's trace minerals, and it's water, and it's predominantly water. Mm-hmm. You know, that list of things that I just presented, none of those are exclusive to the animal. They're all present in plants.
So let's say you take a pea plant.
Right.
Walk me through how that pea becomes a ersatz chicken right. strip.
So you take the pea and you basically mill it, and you have to separate the protein from the fat. So what you do is you put an aqueous solution, a water-based solution in place, where you change the pH levels, and that will separate out the protein from the carbohydrates and from the fat.
Where do you get your plants now?
The peas that we use are actually grown in Canada and grown in France. But it's not about the particular plant. It's really about the idea that the plant kingdom is a source of amino acids, right? And so if you think about it that way, there's an enormous number of plants that we could use to take protein from. And it's really interesting ones, like cottonseed has great protein. We would never do this, but tobacco leaves has a pretty good source of protein, right? Lupin, camelina, mustard seed is one of my favorites. So there's all these different places you can pull protein from. So anyway, so we mill it. It's crushed, basically. It's separated, right? And this is done by a supplier of ours. And then we take that protein, right? And we run it through a really simple process of heating, cooling, and pressure.
And the machine is an extruder
does
the heating and the cooling and the pressure.
Exactly, yeah.
Is anything lost by changing the shape of the protein? You know, I think of like boiling broccoli. You lose so much of the nutrients rather than steaming it.
Right, right. What's cool is that it's basically been stripped down to its protein, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're just changing the form. You're stitching it together in a new way, but there's not some sort of fundamental conversion where it becomes a lesser protein.
So you're trying to mimic meat. Have you thought of calling it something else? Because in a way, maybe when you started out, you thought, well, how can I make a replacement for meat? But aside from those people who have been eating meat who are alive, I mean, you have new generations of people being born.
Yeah.
You could call it plant
yeah.
or whatever word you want to put to it.
Yeah. My mother is after me for the exact same thing. Every time we talk about it, she said, why are you trying to... I'm like, well, because what we talked about with respect to the role that meat has played in our culture, I'm really focused on providing a absolutely convincing piece of meat just made from plants. Yeah.
So I want to go back to the early days. You graduated from Columbia Business School and went to work at Ballard Power Systems, which is a fuel cell company making clean batteries, basically. Mm. Is that right?
Yeah. Clean fuel cells, yeah.
So you've always had kind of this conservation ethos. Where did that arise?
It certainly comes from my dad. When I was growing up, I always think about my dad in this way, that have you ever seen a deer, like in Central Park? Like, they just don't belong. They're like scared. They're like, I got to get out of here. That's my dad. He hates the city. And so every chance he got, he would pack our car up and he would drive us out to our farm. He taught me there about the natural world, and I fell in love with it. My dad is a professor. He's at McGill now, but when I was a kid, he was at the University of Maryland. We have a farm in the western part of the state that was supposed to be a hobby farm. We turned it into a real business where we had Holstein dairy cattle, about 100 head of Holstein dairy cattle.
At what point did you start thinking about this idea of meat replacement? What was the catalyst for getting to this topic?
It took me a really long time. And really about courage, I think, first and foremost, and a willingness to let my own heart speak to who I am versus what I thought people thought I should be.
What did you think they thought you should be?
So I had like formal training and was like very focused on climate through energy. I just felt that it wasn't serious enough to like go start like some kind of tofu factory. But I had this sense that, you know, there was something amiss.
You started reading about livestock and the meat industry, and you came across a paper written by two professors at the University of Missouri, Fu Hung She and Harold Huff.
Yeah.
What was their paper about, and how did you find them?
I was thinking about, how do I get into this field? So I started to make some small investments in restaurants that were doing well, serving plant-based food. And everything that we were doing, we had to basically disguise the product in something. I just began to think about the science behind it. So there's no reason that you need to run all this through an animal. And so I started reading. And it's really a story about the internet. I mean, I like literally would just stay up at night and read whatever I could find. Right. And over time, I came over across what Fu Hung was doing and what Harold was doing. And I called them up and said, hey, I'd like to come out and talk to you.
At what point did you decide, okay, we're going to partner and I'm going to license the technology from
right.
you?
So they had actually, you know, this extrusion has been around for a long time. What they did was develop basically a set of variables let's think about it like a lock on a safe. Like, you know, you can know that you have to have three numbers there, but if you don't know the sequence and everything else or the numbers, you're kind of stuck. And so they found the exact right combination of heating, cooling, pressure that I felt created this really realistic muscle form, this restitching of protein into muscle form. I would basically produce as much as I possibly could in a day at the University of Missouri in their lab, right? And then we would take it back. I would take it back to Maryland. I would fly back, you know, hundreds of pounds of chicken, and we didn't have a place to store it, so I would put ice in my bathtub.
So you would just jump on a commercial airplane with
yeah.
with a sack of chicken?
And there's funny episodes like where Once it opened in the overhead and started falling out chicken, and Southwest was like, what's wrong with you? You can buy those big bags from Southwest for like $35. So I would show up at the airport with as cold as I could keep it.
Stored in the overhead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, sometimes the boxes would open and people are like, what are you carrying? Why do you have all this chicken? And I'd be like very flattered. I'd be like, thank you for asking that way. But
glad you think it's chicken.
Yeah, exactly. But to answer about how did I license it was really interesting. We were working on this for a long time. I was up at our farm, and my neighbor came over to me and said, I just read about this chicken that's being developed in the University of Missouri. I was like, wait, that's the product I'm working on. But Time Magazine had run an article, and the sort of press office of the University of Missouri had orchestrated it. And so, you know, I was like, I called up Harold, and I said, Harold, what are you doing? Like, this is, we were partners. He said, you know what? They were under very sharp orders to basically just do this, to not communicate it, et cetera. But you know what? They were like, they got inundated with calls. Like all these big corporations wanted to license it. Absolutely incredible to me. Harold Fuhong and the Tech Transfer Office at Missouri was like, we already got a guy. And they gave me a license. I mean, isn't that amazing?
So at the time that you got the license through this kind of backdoor way, thanks to Time Magazine,
yeah.
Was it basically you and how many others were you working with in Maryland?
Right. So we had a very small team. So I started the business and almost immediately started importing what I felt was the very best protein that I could find. And that came out of Asia, because Asia, the Buddhist temples, they've done a lot of work on this for hundreds of years, right? And so I started to import from a Taiwanese company a basic protein that was like beef, right? And it was, you know, soy and wheat. It wasn't very sophisticated, but I began to sell it to Whole Foods. We would run it through very large kettles in a kitchen that we rented out in the evenings from a restaurant. And would sell it into Whole Foods prepared foods section.
Now, how did you get into Whole Foods? I mean, you don't have a background in right. You don't have these relationships.
Persistence, absolutely. You just call and call and call.
When did you get your first investors, and who were they?
I funded the early part of the company.
So how much?
I don't have the figure with me, but far more than like over $100,000 for sure. And then raised money from friends and family, and then. I got the license, and then I sent a note out to basically every venture firm that I could find.
Right? And you didn't have any relationships pre-existing?
No.
And this is from Western Maryland that you were writing to Kleiner Perkins?
I did write to Kleiner, yeah. I emailed, and I remember the title of my email was A Prius for the Plate.
Okay.
it was not super effective, though. but Kleiner reached out to Missouri independently. And Missouri connected with me, and I've been through some tough times with them, and I can't say enough good things about them.
You were their first food-based investment.
Yeah.
Can you give me some more color on that first encounter?
Sure. Two partners there, Ray Lane and then a junior partner named Mole Desponde, were the ones that looked at the company, and even they had to convince their own partners, like, this made sense, right? And, you know, it was sort of, there was some kind of derisive perspectives on the company that, you know, this is sort of fake meat. What are you doing? But Ray was and others on the board have always been there and said, no, let's get this done.
Bill Gates is an investor. The Twitter founders, Ev Williams and Biz Stone, mm-hmm. are investors.
Sure, yep.
How did they come to be a part of this?
I met Biz through Kleiner.
And Bill Gates?
Yeah, same thing. I mean,
through Kleiner.
Yes. When we first had the meeting with him, I can remember being briefed that, you know, he's gonna zero in on some sort of mathematical part of your presentation and ask you to do it, you know. And so I relentlessly studied my presentation to make sure that I wasn't caught off guard by some statistic or something. All the guy wanted to talk about was his family, how good the food was. He was like the nicest guy. So it was a wonderful meeting, and we've gotten to know him, you know, fairly well throughout this.
So I want to talk about the actual meat. What did it taste like when you first started off, and now what does it taste like?
Sure. I think what we got right in the beginning was the underlying texture of meat, so that kind of striation and that resistance that you get when you bite into a piece of meat.
But the taste wasn't there, but the texture was there.
No, the taste wasn't there. The aroma. You know, distribution of fat was not there. Oh, yeah, the aroma was not there. The overall appearance was not there. It's still not there, actually. And so, it was like the whole balance of parts was missing. And so it's interesting. We kept working with food scientists to try to overcome that. But I feel that the real breakthrough that happened for us was when we started to bring in a scientist from other disciplines, a fellow from Stanford, Jody Puglisi, who's the chair of the molecular biology department at Stanford Medical. that started to make real breakthroughs.
Was there a breakthrough moment technologically on a chemical level?
Yeah, for sure. The distribution of fat and water, for example. So we can take a piece of chicken, a chicken breast, or a piece of beef and put it under an MRI like you would your knee, and you can begin to study and understand exactly how water, fat, and protein are distributed. As you gain that more fundamental understanding, you can improve your products. Hmm. And so we didn't have that in the beginning.
Any other example like that?
So there's 600 molecules. There's 600 molecules that give the flavor and aroma of meat, right? We have a system that allows us to try to identify what are the key drivers of those 600. But it's not only the presence of the molecules, how are they combining and reacting under heat?
What has been harder for you than you thought? What in terms of building the business was harder for you than you thought?
Getting out of the meat alternative section. Meat alternative section is not where you want to be. It's just a penalty box. It's a forgotten.
Where would you like to be?
In the meat case, which is where we are now. So we got into the meat case at Whole Foods, which has been transformational for our business. I mean, absolutely transformational. If you're looking at that in the frozen section versus what we sell in the fresh meat case, we sell about 13 times more in the fresh meat case because that's where consumers buy meat.
Speaking of Whole Foods, there was a recall, I think, in 2014. Yeah. They were selling curry chicken,
awesome.
And accidentally they used your chicken instead of animal-based protein chicken.
Yeah, yeah.
What happened?
It was, for I think 3 days or so. They sold a basically prepared curry chicken dish. And so consumers were eating our product thinking it was animal protein and eating animal protein thinking it was our product. And they just got the labels wrong. Someone in the kitchen just got two bags and got the labels wrong. And I think what that speaks to is when you put those early products of ours into something, they are pretty indistinguishable from animal protein. But so naked, they're not.
Did any of the consumers realize that it wasn't?
I don't know how it became discovered. I think someone finally realized the tags were wrong or something.
That's ironically good press
for you.
It
was a very good compliment, yeah.
And anything happened from that in terms of sales or?
No, one of the big things that happened at that point in the company was, I think, a couple, like 6 months prior to that, a guy named Mark Bittman wrote a really flattering piece about the company and was on the front page of the Sunday Review and the New York Times. That changed everything for us.
So Mark Bittman being the food critic for the Times.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so he came out to, at that time we were at we took over a kitchen in an abandoned hospital in Western Maryland. And Bittman, through a friend of mine, Kathy Freston, had connected with me and said, I want to come see what you're doing. I actually went to his apartment and we made him dishes of our product and an animal protein equivalent.
Where is it in Manhattan?
Manhattan, yeah. And we asked him to differentiate between them, which ones. And he had trouble telling us. Like, it was like 7 dishes. He couldn't figure out which is which. He said, I want to come out and see how you do this. So he came out to the facility, drove him out there, and he did this great piece, video, everything. And that, for me, I think, put the company on the map.
How would your parents describe you?
My mom once said that I'm big and can lift a lot.
Metaphorically. Is that what she meant?
No, I think she actually physically meant it. I don't know. I mean, I think they, I'm not sure. You know, I was a little bit of, there's a little bit of kind of Huck Finn. Like I, the classes I didn't want to pay attention to, I didn't, mm-hmm. you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I didn't become a really good student until I was in college. But curious and mm-hmm. kind of full of life, I think, would be how I'd be described as a kid. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, sure.
My guest has been Ethan Brown, founder of Beyond Meat. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.